KZSU FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the last show of this quarter on KZSU. I'm very excited to have on Professor Nick Bostrom, who is the director of the Future of Humanity Institute and a professor at the Faculty of Philosophy at Oxford Martin School at the University of Oxford. Nick's work is quite interesting, and we're going to be drilling down on a couple of areas that he focuses on, partially in his capacity as a director of the Future of Humanity Institute, and we're going to talk about that as well. We're going to be discussing broadly machine intelligence as well as what Nick has identified as a series of information hazards. So two topics that are related but certainly distinct, but both areas of, I think, of broad interest, and I'm excited to have Nick on to talk about these issues. Machine intelligence and the ability ultimately to create systems that allow for machines to mimic is probably, I think, the best way to put it, mimic human cognitive abilities is one that is rife with a number of ethical issues as well as technological questions. And what we do with machine intelligence and how it's created is something that partially we'll be discussing today. In addition, another topic that we'll be focusing on is transparency, or more specifically, information hazards. Certainly in 2010, there has been a resurgence in a belief, and a broad-based belief, that as a general matter, transparency is good. And by transparency, we really just mean free and open exchange of information. And primarily we're thinking of governmental bodies, but also it can be private industry as well. There has been a pushback lately among some scholars that have pointed out that perhaps not all transparency is a good thing. And while it hasn't put the brakes on this effort, it certainly has caused some to pause. And Nick's work focusing on information hazards, we're going to talk a bit about transparency, what some of those hazards are, and how policy might best deal with these issues. Nick is a prolific writer in a variety of areas, and on his webpage at nickbostrom.com, he talks about a working assumption and we'll talk about this, contextualizes the work that Nick does. And quoting from his website, he says, "High leverage questions deserve to be studied with at least the same level of scholarship that academics routinely apply to all manner of arcane trivia. This assumption might be wrong. Perhaps we are so irredeemably inept at thinking about the big picture that it is good that we usually don't. Perhaps attempting to wake up will only result in bad dreams. But how will we know unless we try?" Nick, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture and laying down the gauntlet up front.
Thank you for inviting me to your program.
Nick, let's start out with a general background question. And certainly this is a show that's airing in the United States, and people may not be familiar with your work, although the show also airs as a podcast throughout the world. Let's start with your background in a bit more detail. Talk a bit about your background and your primary scholarly focus as you see it.
Well, I've got a motley scholarly background. I studied physics and computational neuroscience, as well as mathematical logic and philosophy, especially. Although my main anchorage right now is in a philosophy faculty, I see philosophy really as on a continuum with other sciences and other disciplines, really an overlapping part of that continuum. So for me, I'm trying to draw from whatever disciplines happen to be most relevant to the questions I'm thinking about, which tend to be big picture questions, questions where the answer might really make a fundamental difference to our views about which direction we should be heading in as a society or as a species.
And of course, there are a lot of big questions that we could ask, and you've drilled down on a few. I've mentioned a few, and you drilled down on several. If you were to identify, if there is a way to do it, a primary scholarly focus as of now, what would it be within that broad realm?
Well, right now I'm working on a book on the prospect of machine intelligence, really focusing in not on the near-term future of AI, but on what happens if and when one day we manage to create computers with general intelligence equaling that of human brains. And then thinking about what happens after that, because one of the things that seems quite possible is that although it's very difficult to predict how long it is until we'll get to any kind of human-level AI, it seems likely that once we do get to that stage, we might soon thereafter get to superhuman levels of intelligence. So I want to think about the dynamic that arises in that situation where such a breakthrough occurs. How steep will that transition be? Will it be located to one place? And what are the risks that arise from that? And how can we better deal with those risks? But that's sort of my current focus. But it grows out of a wider concern with existential risks and with other big picture questions for humanity.
And that's where I want to go now by way of background for listeners. Tell us a bit about the Future of Humanity Institute. What is its mission? Where is it housed? And what does it do ultimately?
Well, so we are a small institute with a big name, though. We are part of Oxford University, a multidisciplinary research institute, whose mission is really to try to apply careful thinking and excellent scholarship to big picture questions for humanity, such as questions of whether there are risks to the survival of Earth-originating intelligent life, or whether, for example, in the future we might develop technologies that make it possible to transform, to change human nature in some profound way. Also questions related to methodology, like you might be very interested in these big picture or far future questions, but how is it actually possible to know anything at all about these? Can we become more rational in the way we approach these questions? And how ultimately does all of this connect to current day policy decisions and what we have most reasons to do as individuals?
And is the center itself, does it run academic programs as well? Do you have doctoral students? I'm curious, just that perhaps that's a bit of an academic inside baseball, but I'm curious.
Well, we are primarily a research institution. Mm-hmm. We don't accept any students at the moment. So our main mission is research, original research on these topics. We also do some amount of outreach trying to stimulate wider interest, both in the academic community, among the general public, and sometimes advising policymakers.
And I should add that you're joining us by Skype from your office there. With regard to, and one last question about the Future of Humanity Institute, how long have you been affiliated with it? And perhaps you could talk a little bit about its history, when it was founded, and where what its beginnings were.
Well, it was created some 5 years ago or so. I was its founding director, so I've been with it from the outset. And it's part of a larger structure here at Oxford University called the Oxford Martin School, which was created at the same time as the FHI, thanks to a very generous benefaction from Dr. James Martin, who wanted to make it possible for scholars in the university to work in interdisciplinary team on tackling the really pressing practical questions for human society in the 21st century. And so we are a part of that larger structure.
With regard to your working assumption that I quoted at the beginning, as I mentioned, you lay down the gauntlet in a rather provocative way, and I want to ask you the impetus for it. phrasing the assumption against the criticism, really, that, as you say, academics routinely apply rigor to all manner of arcane trivia. I have to imagine that there was an impetus for writing this statement and putting it so prominently on your website. So can you talk a little bit about what compelled you to come up with and post your working assumption?
Well, there are probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of academics and scientists around the world thinking about all sorts of things from between heaven and earth. But very, very few of those are actually thinking about these bigger picture questions that I was just referring to. And yet it seems that until we have some kind of informed opinion on these big picture questions, we can't really have any rational confidence that all the work we do on the small questions will actually help us move in a desirable direction. For all we know, it might be that, say, more rapid advances in some technological areas will make things worse or will increase the total amount of existential risk or bring us faster to the precipice than slower progress. It's kind of paradoxical that the most important questions we face as a species have tended to be relegated to journalists and to maybe a retired physicist to write a popular science book on some of these topics, but not really been subjected to the kind of sustained, careful, critical scrutiny that you would expect from any other much less important topic. We did, for example, just recently... a little literature comparison between the amount of scholarship devoted on the one hand to human extinction and on the other hand to the dung beetle. And we found that by more than an order of magnitude, there were more papers written on the topic of the dung beetle than on the topic of human extinction. Now, I don't want to belittle the dung beetle. It's an interesting animal to look at, and one can learn lessons that might apply to other animals. But still, it's hard to think that it somehow is 10 times more important than the question of human extinction. Even if you narrow it down to just looking at dung beetle reproduction, you still get more papers on that than on human extinction. So it's a little example of the sense of lack of proportion that one finds if one really takes a step back and I think, does this scheme of priorities that we see really make sense? And no, it doesn't really make sense.
And I have to say, I'm not part of that problem. I don't have any dung beetle topics at all in my queue of things to write about, but it does raise and it's a great statistic, I think, to use to make your point. It does cause one, I think you're right, to question what academics are doing. And I'll ask you your own theory. I mean, why do you think it is, or do you have a working theory on why so many scholars focus on arcane trivia?
Well, I mean, I don't have a complete theory of it. I suppose there are some observations that might help illuminate it. I mean, I think a lot of academics don't care ultimately what the significance of their work is. You know, maybe they went to graduate school, or they had some charismatic supervisor who happened to be working in one particular area, so they started working in that area as well. And, you know, 40 years later, they are still working on that area, and that's how their life unfolded, and that's what they spent their life doing. There isn't necessarily a time in the average scientist's or academic's life when they stand back and think about, of all these possible topics that I could spend my life researching, which is the one that is actually going to do the most to help the world, or is going to do the most to illuminate the fundamental questions. It's more natural for a lot of people just to go with the flow. Of course, there is also a lot of inertia in a system like academia. There are disciplines that have arisen for various historical reasons, and then research continues to be funded that fits into the paradigm and exemplars that those disciplines have created. And then they split into subdisciplines. But if you're trying to do something that doesn't fit neatly within one of these predefined fields, then you might find it harder to get grants or to find journals that will accept your papers and so forth. And of course, a lot of academic research seems to serve to a large extent to sort of show off the skill of the researcher rather than to actually, you know, push back the darkness that surrounds us. In some areas, there might be kind of an over reliance on you know, formal apparatus or experimental technique or expensive instrumentation or logic chopping or fine distinctions. And sometimes there is a kind of one loses the purpose that was ultimately the reason why all of this activity is taking place.
Have you gotten do you have a sense of any reactions to this working assumption? Has anyone ever confronted you on it or said anything about it to you?
Well, with the wider audience, there's usually a very enthusiastic response. I mean, I've had many people I've explained a little bit what we are doing who say, like, so grateful that at least somebody is trying to look at these questions. And a great level of interest, and among, I mean, academics too, the reaction is it has been positive. But usually, when you go into some specific, I mean, it's, to be fair, it's hard to say. So you have the Future of Humanity Institute. We're looking at big picture questions. Well, what the heck does that mean? And it's only when you really present an example of the kind of research we do that people in academia can see, yeah, no, I can see that makes sense. This is an interesting consideration, this argument here. It makes sense. And one really needs to present, like, concrete specimens of the kind of analysis that we do. And then that often connects to what people are doing in different areas, and some of them get interested.
The Future of Humanity Institute uses a phrase that allows us a segue into the first of the two big ideas that we'll focus on today on Hearsay Culture, which is the phrase "a crucial consideration," and that's something that your institute uses as a phrase to identify the kinds of topics that you focus on. Is there a definition, or do you have a particular way that you would describe the characteristics of a crucial consideration?
Well, a crucial consideration is an idea or argument that might plausibly reveal the need not just for some minor course adjustment in our practical endeavors, but a major change or direction of our priority. So it's the kind of insight which, if you got it and if it turns out to be right, might completely change your overall scheme of priorities rather than just some detail about what you were doing. And there are only a limited number of these crucial considerations. Most things just don't have that potential to completely transform our worldview or our sense of priorities. But if you can find such a thing, it's potentially extremely important because it might, you know, have tremendous ripple-on effects across many, many areas of our life and policy and science.
Can you give a couple of examples of some crucial considerations that you or your colleagues have recently identified?
Well, they're a little bit conditional, but one example might be this concept of an existential risk, which is a threat either to the survival of intelligent Earth-originating life or a threat that might permanently and drastically destroy our future potential. So an existential risk, in a sense, would be a risk of an end to the human story. And they differ from all other kinds of risks because they would be permanent. So the history of our species shows many big disasters. We have the Black Plague, we have world wars, Holocaust, we have famines, and all kinds of horrible things have happened. But if you zoom out and look at humanity, as it were, from a cosmic point of view, even the biggest of these disasters have not significantly altered the total amount of human life, human happiness, human suffering there will ever have been. If you plot, for example, a graph of world population, then world wars and other disasters will not even show up. They will kind of be lost in the noise. And at the end of the day, I mean, if the human species lasts for another 100,000 years, then these will have been just like mere ripples on the great pond of life. An existential catastrophe is qualitatively different in that there would be no possibility of recovering from it. It would permanently shape our future, either by cutting it off completely or by sort of locking us in to some radically suboptimal state. Now, how does this lead to a crucial consideration? Well, we have to combine this with some theory of value, and there are many of these. And on some theories of values, existential risk is not necessarily part of a crucial consideration, but on many other popular theories, it would be. So suppose you are a utilitarian, or you are some other kind of what a philosopher might call aggregative consequentialist, meaning that you think that the total value sort of adds up. So if you have two people, there is twice as much value as one person, and you place value on future generations as well as on existing generations. You don't temporally discount the future just because it is in the future. If you have that kind of value, which a lot of people profess to have, but by no means all, then what you find is that reduction of existential risk come up very strongly as the top priority. If you think about the expected utility of reducing existential risk by even the slightest amount, even by, say, reducing it by 0.001%, that good that you will have done thereby will tend to completely trump other good things that you might do, like curing cancer or eliminating world hunger, just because the potential future for humanity is so very large. You know, if we survive, there might be a chance we could colonize the galaxy and beyond and live for millions and millions of years. So any slight change in the probability that will eventually be attained will then tend to trump any other good that you might make. So the crucial consideration here is that if you happen to have this kind of axiology, this kind of value theory, then for all practical purposes, what you have most moral reason to do reduces to the simple imperative, reduce existential risk. And all other good things you can spend your time on are basically distractions from that.
We're chatting with Professor Nick Bostrom, University of Oxford, on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Well, I mean, given what you've just said, Nick, I think I wouldn't be doing my job properly as an interviewer if I didn't ask the obvious follow-up question, which is, if you have identified an existential risk to the existence of humanity that you'd like to reveal on Hearsay Culture. But to put the question more seriously, what do you see as the most significant existential risk today to the future of humanity?
Well, it depends a little bit on how you carve up the risks. But one thing that one sort of basic idea that you pretty quickly get is that the biggest risks over the next 100 years or 200 years or so all seem to be anthropogenic, all arises in one way or another from human activity. And there are kind of two ways to get to this conclusion. You can either think through each particular concrete risk and thinking about the factors that might increase it or decrease it and work through the list. Or you can just take a step back and reflect that the human species has been around for maybe 100,000 years, and we have survived during that time asteroid impacts and earthquakes and windstorms and all kinds of things that nature might throw at us. It seems unlikely then, just intuitively, that if we've survived all of these hazards for 100,000 years, that any of them should do us in within the next 100 years or so. On the other hand, we are now engaging in a lot of new activities that have never been done before, and therefore our long track record of survival doesn't really give us any assurance that these new kinds of hazards that we ourselves are introducing for the first time cannot be significant. So as a first cut, all the really big existential risks arise from human activity, if we are talking about a timescale of a few hundred years, say. More specifically, my view is that all the really big existential risks arise from various powerful technologies that we don't yet have, but which we might develop over the coming decades and centuries, such as, for example, artificial intelligence, which we alluded to earlier, but also perhaps advanced forms of molecular nanotechnology that might make it possible to build new kinds of weapons systems, perhaps synthetic biology, and various kinds of potential nasty applications of that. And there are also some more subtle existential risks that involve not necessarily our extinction, but our permanent lock-in into some radically suboptimal state. So you could imagine various developments in surveillance technology or mind control or crowd control technology that might make it easier for some kind of global totalitarian oppressive regime to eventually arise and make itself permanent. And there are others as well, but I really think that it's future technologies which is the source of the biggest existential risks.
We're chatting with Professor Nick Bostrom, University of Oxford, on KZSU-FM Stanford's Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. You can also go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Either way, I hope you continue to listen to KZSU. Nick, this is a sobering conversation, and I think it's a good time now to turn to what you had mentioned at the beginning is your current primary focus, and something that I mentioned in introduction I wanted to discuss, which is machine intelligence. And I guess I'll start off again with a definitional question, which you kind of alluded to, but what do you mean when you use the phrase machine intelligence? What is it exactly?
Well, I mean, broadly speaking, machine intelligence just means any kind of intelligent information processing that can be implemented on computers. The field of artificial intelligence is broad and motley, and there is no really sharp definition of it. But it would include things like robotic speech recognition, visual processing, software that runs in the background of bank transactions to detect fraud, automatic theory improving, chess playing computers, all kinds of things like that. Now, what I am interested in, as I said before, is not AI or machine intelligence in general. I'm at least for the purposes of this book, I'm specifically focusing in on this hypothetical future development of machines that equal or exceed humans in general intelligence. That is not just competence in some specific cognitive domain, like chess or calculation or something like that, but in general intelligence, i.e. general cleverness, smartness, including common sense, general wisdom, social skills, whatever.
With regard to the current state of technology in machine intelligence, what are its limits? I mean, what's currently the most advanced technology that allows for the highest degree or level of machine intelligence?
It depends a bit on what kind of tasks you think of as requiring high intelligence. It used to be that playing chess was often put forward as an example of something that was extremely intelligence demanding. It's kind of no animal can play chess. This is the epitome of human ingenuity to be able to play chess well. And of course, when computers got good at that and started beating humans, we have retreated from that view. And now there might be other kinds of skills which we seem to regard as embodying the essence of intelligence. So this has been, AI researchers have complained of this, of the kind of the bar keeps changing, that there is something that is being held up as requiring great intelligence, and then when the AI researchers finally succeed in making machines do that, then we say, oh, well, that didn't really require intelligence. But I guess the broader question here is sort of what's the state of the art in AI? Like, how far are we from anything that could be regarded as human equivalent?
Mm-hmm.
I think the answer is quite far, but exactly how long it would take us to go that distance is something you will get very different views on. There is no consensus at all, even among the experts in this field. So among AI researchers in general, or among that small subset of those that actually focus on artificial general intelligence, the views are all over the map, and a lot of people will say it's just very difficult to predict such a thing. And I think that's a fact. I mean, there are many cases we don't know how far away we are from this or how long it will take. And we therefore have to think in terms of a probability distribution of possible arrival dates of superintelligence. And that probability distribution will be smeared out over quite a large temporal interval. So maybe some slight probability that it could happen in a decade or two, you know, probably more likely that it might take 30, 40, 50, 80, 90 years, or maybe it'll take a couple of hundred years. Or we just don't know.
And in fact, in your writing, you have discussed not only machine intelligence, but a related topic of cognitive enhancement, which also, I think, has significant existential questions and risks, as you define them, to the future of humanity. What is cognitive enhancement, and how have technologists conceived the relationship between that and the human being?
Well, cognitive enhancement would be ways of trying to improve our effective cognitive capacities, such as memory, abstract reasoning, and so forth. Normally, when this comes up as a topic in, say, bioethics, what is really meant is biomedical cognitive enhancement, because there is a sense in which we have always practiced cognitive enhancement. Education is a form of cognitive enhancement. At least one hopes that by going through school, you will become better able to think and solve intellectual problems. And our external technology, our computers and so forth, can be seen as external cognitive enhancers. Our institutions can be seen as attempts in many cases to improve our collective intelligence, our ability to aggregate information between many people and jointly reach wise decisions. So it's really not a natural kind here. But in recent years, there's been some attention focused specifically on the idea of using biomedical ways of enhancing the brain through smart drugs or other interventions. So that has attracted a lot of attention recently, although, I mean, right now, that's the smallest part. Like, the really big gains in cognitive capacity, I think, have been through computers and better institutional mechanisms and better learning.
With regard to the research in these areas, who are the people ultimately, or aside from the obvious, are there other disciplines or other groups of individuals that are weighing in heavily on these issues? You mentioned bioethics, but I'm curious if technologists broadly you find have a seat at the table. If you find lawyers or academics in law involved in this discussion. I mean, if there was a roundtable real discussion of the of individuals or groups that are ultimately having influence on the direction that this research is heading. Who are those groups or people?
Well, I'm not sure that the roundtable discussion would be the thing that has a big impact on the actual direction. So there are two kinds of questions we can distinguish here. So one is, if there were some big discussion about human enhancement, so cognitive enhancement is kind of an element, the way it's recently been carved up anyway, has been that there's cognitive enhancement, you can think of enhancements of physical capacities like in sports, doping, you could imagine maybe emotional enhancements, cosmetic enhancements. And there's been some significant discussion over the past decade or so on these issues. And that discussion, bioethicists have been involved, I guess some people from technology, law, some people from a religious background, some have taken an interest in this. But my feeling is that these discussions have not really had a big impact in shaping what actually happens. I think that's might have been much more determined by, for example, our regulatory system for approving pharmaceuticals, which has been very much geared towards the disease model of medicine, where medicine is about identifying, preventing, curing, or mitigating diseases. And enhancement medicine doesn't really fit into that paradigm, because with enhancement medicine, the idea is you can have a healthy person who, there's nothing wrong with them, they just want to become better in some respect. So if you have a drug that, and to get it on the market, you have to show that it is effective against some kind of disease, then you are immediately at a disadvantage when it comes to developing enhancers.
We're talking with Professor Nick Bostrom of the Future of Humanity Institute at the University of Oxford on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. One of the, and again, I don't know if this qualifies as a crucial consideration, but it's certainly something that has gotten a fair amount of media attention and certainly raises a number of ethical questions, is this concern for concern that people could choose the genetic makeup of their children, and therefore the phrase that's become popular is the phrase designer babies. From your perspective, doing the research, putting aside whether how important this is as a consideration, is this a real concern? Are we at a point where we need to have these discussions, or is this a very catchy way to sell magazines and newspapers?
Well, I mean, I don't think as of right now it's on sort of the top of the agenda of most folks' minds. I think the average person has other things that they are much more concerned about. But it's the kind of topic that every once in a while, there'll be some technological advance that occurs, and then there might be an eruption of public discussion for a while after that. So with, you know, going back to Dolly the sheep, when they had the cloning success, then for a while people were talking about cloning, and there's going to be other things like that which are going to bring attention to the issue for a while. I think ultimately, the question of how we will be using our increasing technological powers to modify and change or select among human natures is a very important one, and one that does raise a lot of very interesting philosophical and ethical questions. I think that it's important that that discussion recognizes both sides, both the potential risks and dangers, but also the enormous potential opportunities, if we get this right, of really trying to overcome some of the biological limitations that have held us back. And if you think about a cognitive enhancement, everybody is in favor of education. Everybody is in favor of removing lead from the tap water if we can do it cheaply, because we know that it harms neurological development. And the reason for doing this seems to be that we prefer people to be able to think better, to have cognitively greater capacities rather than to have lower cognitive capacities. And it's very hard for me to see how fundamentally it could matter whether you bring about this outcome through a pill or through removing lead in the tap water or through paying for expensive extra years of schooling. All of these things seems to be pulling in the same direction, and I think they should all be vigorously explored.
With regard to, and we have about 13 minutes left in the interview, Nick, and especially since we're dealing with fundamental questions about the future of humanity, this is particularly unfair, the unfair part of the show, where I ask questions that are unfair in the sense that you don't have enough time to answer them adequately. But I do want to turn to another major focus of your research, and one that deserves some attention now, which are information hazards. And this is a timely topic, particularly given here in the United States, the recent United States Supreme Court decision in Citizen United that has already allowed for massive corporate and anonymous spending on elections in ways that already data is suggesting have significantly impacted the election process. What are information hazards, and what do you see as the primary problem with full transparency, that is complete open door and open government?
Well, an information hazard would be a risk that arises from the dissemination or potential dissemination of true information that might then cause harm or enable some agent to cause harm. So the emphasis here on true information, it's kind of obvious how false information can, in some context, be harmful. But it's also true that true information can cause harm. I wrote a paper introducing this concept of an information hazard and basically tried to just go through a number of very different kinds of ways in which true information can cause harm, just to put them on the map and give them like names so that one can actually think about and discuss them, because they are often a lot more subtle than physical risks and therefore much more easily overlooked. But my view is not so much that we have sort of erred on the side of transparency or gone too far in that direction. I'm rather more agnostic about that. I think it's true that there are these real risks. Now, it's a separate question whether when you weigh these risks up against the risks of trying to suppress information or conceal it or reduce its production, which of these kinds of risks dominate. I don't really take a stand on that. And, you know, maybe it will depend on the domain that you're talking about. So I don't want to rule out that the best strategy overall, all things considered, would be an extreme move to complete transparency and the abolition of most government secrecy and private citizen privacy. I just don't know whether ultimately that would be better or worse. But either way, I think we should definitely recognize the costs of that and particular information hazards.
I do want to push you a little bit there and see if I can elicit a bit more of an opinion with regard to whether you think we as human beings have too much faith in information sharing as a solution to a variety of problems that we face, whether they be public corruption or concerns about the safety of pharmaceuticals and so forth. From your perspective, thinking about information hazards, although not perhaps taking a strong position one way or the other, do you have any observations about our, as humans, faith in information and the sharing of information as a solution to our problems?
Well, I think that there are among some people a kind of naive confidence that this is the right approach, which is not to say that it's the wrong approach. My view is that it's just very difficult to know ultimately whether it's the right approach or wrong approach. I got to say that for me, the key issue here is really not so much the normal questions about privacy and about intellectual property and all of that. I mean, the thing that I'm most interested in regarding information hazards is their connection to existential risk. And I'm concerned about, for instance, future developments in biotechnology, where researchers discover more and more effective ways, perhaps, of modifying pathogens and creating designer viruses, and the technology then to take a digital blueprint of a virus or a microorganism and actually produce an actual virus from that exists and is getting better and easier to use all the time. And I think it's a difficult question whether just making more and more information about, say, how to modify smallpox and so forth available is really the thing that will do the most to reduce this kind of risk. And similarly, with regard to certain other powerful future technologies. We have nuclear weapons. Now, it turned out in the case of nuclear weapons, we were lucky that you need these very difficult to get raw materials to make a nuclear weapon. You need fissile material, uranium, highly enriched uranium or plutonium. But suppose it had to turn out that next time we put our hand into this big urn and we pull up a ball, like a new technological invention, that the next time around we get some technology that you don't need a rare raw material, you just need the know-how. And instead of having to use plutonium, you just use sand and whatever it might be, some readily available raw material, and then it puts these enormous destructive powers in the hand of whoever has that information. It's easy to see how a situation like that might lead to an unsustainable state of affairs. So that's more where my real concern is with regard to information hazards.
With regard to those kinds of concerns, and I'm not asking you to pull out a crystal ball, but I do want to spend our remaining time focusing on what you view as under-theorized and analyzed areas within this sphere. If you were to write a manifesto and publish it to academics and researchers, what would be the top one or two topics that you'd say deserve more attention from academics and researchers but are not getting it today, and why?
I'd say existential risks in general, and then, of course, that breaks down into a large number of specific existential risks,
right,
and how they can be reduced. And the problem of how to ensure that if one day you can build a super intelligent machine, how you would ensure that that super intelligence, which will presumably be extremely powerful, for the same reasons that humans with our intelligence are very powerful relative to other animals, how that superintelligence then will be friendly to humans, how it will be benign and safe. This control problem is a very difficult problem, but one that we must solve before we solve the problem of how to build a superintelligence. So those would be two examples of areas where the importance is so enormous, and yet the amount of effort that humanity is currently putting in is really, the amount of people working on these issues can sort of almost be counted on the fingers of one hand.
To the extent that we can attempt to figure out how to prevent these kinds of risks, you've pointed out a number of risks, and you also noted just a few minutes ago how serendipity or happenstance winds up being so important, the luck of having nuclear weapons being difficult to create. If we think about why these risks, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, why we haven't faced as many of these existential risks as we may have, given the list that we might come up with, are there particular characteristics of human beings or of the world, ultimately, aside from the fact that some resources are scarce, that would explain why we survived as long as we have?
Well, it's easy to come up with post hoc rationalizations, and people, with regard to the Cold War, which didn't become a hot war, like a lot of people very confidently then explain why it wasn't really so dangerous after all. But researchers have shown that people have a great overconfidence in their ability to predict outcomes after the fact. That is, that when they know what actually happened, they overestimate their ability in advance to have predicted that was what was going to happen. So one should be careful about these things. There is a much more fundamental issue here, however, which is methodologically difficult. So it's hard to know exactly what the upshot of it is, but it's the idea of an observation selection effect, which is a piece of probability theory where you have to take into account the fact that all observations are preconditioned on the existence of a suitably positioned observer to have the evidence that you're conditioning on. So if it had been the case that, say, every 10,000 years, something happened on an average Earth-like planet that completely wiped out any human-like life on it, we would still not expect to find ourselves on a planet where that had happened, mm-hmm. because we wouldn't be there to find that. So there are these observation selection effects that kind of guarantee that we must find ourselves on a planet and in a history where intelligent life hasn't yet gone extinct, no matter how probable or improbable that was. Our observation is filtered by the precondition that there still are observers to have the evidence. And you got to correct for this. You got to take this into account when you form some view of how big the risks were in the past. And this is a very difficult and methodologically challenging area of probability theory, but one that turns out to be very important when you're thinking about existential risks and their magnitudes.
For those that are interested in reading more of your work and learning more about what you are doing, Nick, where can they go?
I would point them to my homepage, which is at nickbostrom.com. Or if you Google my name, you can get there directly. I have a lot of preprints and articles of my scholarly work and popular writings, etc.
Professor Nick Bostrom, the director of the Future of Humanity Institute at University of Oxford. Nick, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. I mean, clearly, these issues of existential risks require more discussion, which is the main reason I invited you on today. And I think that obviously these are discussions for which we can only touch the tip of the iceberg. I might ask you, recognizing that publications take time, if you have a rough time estimate for when your book on machine intelligence will be published?
It's always hazardous to try to estimate.
I won't hold you to it.
I think that the wise response here would be to abstain from venturing any
fair enough.
Any forecast of that.
Fair enough. Yeah, there's some things I guess we just can't predict. But nonetheless, I look forward to that book, and I look forward to inviting you back on the show. Thank you for taking the time today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you. It's been good to talk to you.
I'm very excited to mention a number of guests that are coming up next quarter. Again, this being the last show of the quarter, being recorded on November 17th, 2010. But coming up next quarter will be, among others, Ryan Kahlo, the director of the Consumer Privacy Project at Stanford Center for Internet and Society, Associate Dean Michael Madison of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, Evgeny Morozov of Foreign Policy and author of How Dictators Learn to Stop Worrying and Love the Web, Professor Jennifer Urban, the director of the Samuelson Law, Technology, and Public Policy Clinic at UC Berkeley, Professor David Post of Temple University's Beasley School of Law, author of In Search of Jefferson's Moose, Notes on the State of Cyberspace, Professor Dan Hunter of New York Law School, Jamei Cassio, discussing his book Hacking the Earth, Professor Andy Hiley of my colleague at Elon University School of Law, discussing online sales taxation, Professor Dan Solove of George Washington University Law School, author of Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security, Professor Ramesh Srinivasan, Department of Information Studies and Design and Media Arts at the University of California, Los Angeles, and Kevin Paulson of Wired Magazine, author of Kingpin, How One Hacker Took Over the Billion-Dollar Cybercrime Underground. Again, this is the last show of the quarter on KZSU, indeed the last show, I believe, of the year, although we might have a show right before New Year's Day, depending on when the new schedule kicks in. But nonetheless, I hope you've enjoyed this quarter of shows. As always, you have a number of ways that you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can pick it up live Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time on KZSU. Best way to get the show. But you can also get it by podcast by going either to hearsayculture.com or by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Or lastly, by going to our iTunes, CIS's iTunes page, by typing Center for Internet Society into the iTunes search engine. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. This has been a particularly busy semester, and so I have been slow to respond to emails, but I do respond to all of them in time. But I always appreciate those comments and feedback on the show or anything else I could be doing better or guests I should have on. So again, thank you for listening to the show this quarter. I look forward to picking up our discussion at the end of the year and the beginning of next year. Enjoy the holiday season, and please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming. Have a great day.